Hello and welcome in.
First Science. Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Hello and welcome to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. While London is far from the pea supers of times gone by, pollution is still a problem that the city battles with. From the burning of coal through to modern diesel buses, trucks and cars, there has always been a fouling of the air. But pollution is on the retreat. My guest today is Andrew Grieve. Andrew works as a senior air quality analyst in the Environmental Research Group at King's College London, where they look into monitoring, modelling and advising on the air quality in and around London, working out how we can get a handle on the fog and filthy air. Welcome, Andrew.
Good morning. Hi.
And so how did you get here this morning, Andrew? What's the healthiest way that you got in?
I cycled.
You cycled. So actually, it's still a pretty good way to get into work, even though you're cycling through all this pollution.
Yeah. Weekends are always lower than weekdays. So that's a good start.
That is a good start. And today we've also got in the studio Louise and Kira, who's joining the Science Mixtape team. Hello. Welcome to the crew.
Hi. Thanks very much.
Well, so you've actually got a question, or we normally have a brain teaser in the mornings, but you've got a question today which is slightly different. What have we got?
We'd like your best guess for the definition for the following word. What is hemiclophobia a fear of?
Hemiclophobia. Okay. What is hemiclophobia a fear of? So have a guess by sending us in a tweet to @sciencemixtape, and we'll see what the best guesses are. So, Andrew, let's kick off with your first track. You've chosen Whitechapel by Blue Rose Code. Mm. Why did you choose this?
You can probably tell from my accent, I grew up in Edinburgh. I came to London in 2005 and got involved in the music scene here, and came across this guy called Ross Wilson, who had also grown up in Edinburgh and come to London a few years before me. Was in the music scene, and I ended up playing with him for a while. I played drums with him for a while, and he writes a lot of his music is about kind of feeling displaced and ideas of where home is or not. And this song speaks to that idea of being kind of a Scotsman in London.
Watch the thread of light, trace the day. In all these shapes I play, and as they rise and fade, there's a cherry full of night. Marigold and mandarin, where the Boston sunset slips between. All my busted dreams are sky linen, and I won't fear, for every morning I have left. For every day that I'll draw breath.
Soot that remains in caves in China suggests humans have been polluting the earth since the last ice age.
Well, it's been a long time. We've been really messing up the planet. But right now, let's start at the beginning, Andrew. What is the air pollution? What are we looking at? What's it made from?
There's two main types of pollution. There's gases and particles, and we measure both in the UK and Europe, around the world. So the main types of pollution that we're worried about and that we're monitoring are nitrogen dioxide, mm-hmm. ozone. We know ozone from the ozone layer, in the summertime we get ground level ozone. Sulfur dioxide, mainly from kind of coal burning from factories.
This is like the eggy, is that the right?
Yeah.
It kind of smells like rotten eggs.
Yeah. We used to have a lot of sulfur dioxide in the 90s that caused acid rain, like
sulfuric acid in the rain.
And we remember buildings kind of gradually dissolving.
Acid rain.
And then sulfur was largely removed from fuel, as was lead as well. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of solved that problem. Actually, that's a good example of kind of legislation, like monitoring and then seeing the problem and then legislation coming along and kind of solving it.
Does that actually, so that's got rid of some of the gases, but you said there was also particulates.
Yes.
So what's that?
So particles, at the moment, we just measure all particles of a certain size. So we're looking at particles that are 10 microns, so PM10, 10 microns, and PM2.5, 2.5 microns, so
right.
Really, really, really tiny particles that are mainly coming from exhaust emissions, tiny particles from exhaust emissions. But they're made of all sorts of stuff. So there's carbon and you know, bits of unburnt carbon from exhaust, but there's also tire wear, brake wear, road surface wear. So there's metals and bits of stuff in there. We just kind of we measure all of it of a certain size. But within that, there will be some stuff that is more and less toxic. And actually, there's a lot of work going on at the moment to try and work out exactly which components of this particulate is having the toxic effect to our health.
So what are the kind of effects that are on our health? And are there certain, you're saying certain things are more dangerous than others? What are the ones that we should be concerned about, you know, at the moment?
So in London, in the UK, the two main things that we're worried about at the moment are nitrogen dioxide and particulates, particularly PM2.5, which is the smaller ones that can get deeper into our lungs. There's always kind of all of these pollutants, when we breathe them in, interact with the lining of our lungs.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that you don't really think about it a lot, but the inside of your lungs are exposed to the atmosphere, you know, even though they're kind of inside you, you don't really think about
the fact that... Yeah, it's kind of like it's on the outside of your skin, right? Because everything you walk through, you breathe in and it goes...
Absolutely.
It's not really inside your body, it's kind of outside your body, inside your body.
Yeah, it's a really weird thing to think about, but yeah, the lining of your lungs are kind of exposed to the atmosphere and all of these things that you breathe in. And all of these things like nitrogen dioxide, ozone, you know, metals in these particles and stuff have an oxidizing effect. So they're kind of, so the lining of your lung is coated with an antioxidant to try and deal with these challenges that come in. But if pollution gets above a certain level, then your antioxidant lining is depleted. And at some point you'll start to have a kind of an inflammatory reaction.
Right.
A very small scale, a very, very kind of small
scale. And that can affect the functioning of your lungs?
Yeah,
make it
over
harder?
Time. Over
okay.
time.
So it's the prolonged exposure that's the real problem.
Yeah. I mean, for people who have underlying conditions, underlying cardiovascular conditions or breathing conditions, then air pollution is going to affect them possibly on a day-to-day basis. For the rest of us who won't feel an effect, even if air pollution is kind of moderate or high, it's that long-term exposure that has the effect over our lifetime.
Right, and so you were saying that kind of pollution at the moment, that's the problem. Has it changed over time?
Mm.
Like, what used to be the biggest deal, and now how has it changed to today?
Yeah, so if you look at... There's the great smog of 1952 in London, where there was a kind of stagnant, it was very cold, the air was very stagnant. Mm-hmm. In those times, people were burning coal in their houses for heating, essentially. And there were power stations in cities. You know, think of what is now the Tate Modern was a power station, and what is now being the Battersea as well, you know. Massive power stations burning coal, pumping out trains as well. Trains were, you know, coal.
Oh, really? Okay.
Coal fire. You know, you see the old footage of the guys
shoveling
the coal
into the back of the train. So we were burning a lot of kind of dirty materials.
Yeah.
And is it the coal generates these particulate materials? Is that what the problem is?
Yeah,
so then the
absolutely.
Air is heavily laden with all these particles, and that's when you can't see through it.
Yeah, and that's those P super smogs that you see. Old pictures of black and white pictures of people kind of, you know, walking. In fact, there's pictures of police holding flares in front of buses so that they could drive along the street.
So the visibility was that low that you couldn't see in front of the bus. A few meters of visibility.
Yeah, there's another picture of a goalkeeper standing in the Arsenal. Good, and you couldn't see anything.
The ball rolls next to him, and he just can't even see it. Doesn't even attempt to save it.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's how it used to be.
So back in the, can you talk about the 50s, there was this, you know, smog, but now we don't see those kind of that kind of stuff anymore.
No.
And is that because the particles have got smaller, or they've just, they're not here anymore? What's changed?
So around that time we had the NHS as well, and we started to kind of collect data and statistics about hospital admissions and why people were coming into hospital, and also started recording deaths as well. And it was around that time that the first kind of linkage between these air pollution events and people coming into hospital and, you know, complaining of breathing conditions or also dying as well, we were able to link the two together. There was an enormous number of early deaths because of this air pollution episode. But we were able to kind of prove it, with hospital admissions and those statistics. That led to the Clean Air Act,
right?
Which essentially banned coal burning in London and Manchester and Birmingham and other cities across the UK, and that had a huge effect. And if you look at kind of concentrations of black smoke as we measured it, there's a massive decrease after the Clean Air Act. But then we started buying more and more and more cars, and our cities filled up with vehicles. So now the main pollution source is traffic and vehicles in our cities. And of course, over that period of time, we also have had more people moving into cities to live in cities. So there's more people living right next to these roads and busy roads and all these vehicles that we have. So that's right. The problem now. And yeah, you're right. The particles that come out of vehicles are much smaller than what we have from kind of coal and wood burning.
But as you were saying, now that they're smaller, they might actually get through the ones of the lungs. So, I mean, this was all driven by this, you know, getting data on the number of people who come into hospitals and stuff. And this is what you're working on. This is what we're going to be talking about a little later. But I think first we're going to go on to your next song. So you've chosen Camaloco by Go Go Penguin. Why did you choose this one?
I came across these guys kind of by accident two or three years ago. They were on some, there was like a Spotify plugin that kind of linked to Guardian reviews of albums, and you could like read the review and play the album. And I thought, wow, that's a weird name. I wonder what these sound like. And I just think they're absolutely extraordinary. They're just three guys, but the sound that they make is like, it's like an orchestra. It sounds way more than three guys.
Brilliant.
They're so exciting.
So here's Go Go Penguin.
Given that it contributes to the death of 40,000 people a year, air pollution is the second biggest health concern behind smoking.
Wow. So it's actually quite... But I didn't realise that second... I would assume like heart disease or something, but actually it's a really, really big deal.
Yeah, there's a World Health Organization calculation as well that air pollution worldwide, around the world, contributes to the early deaths of 7.5 million people.
Wow.
And it's because everyone is affected. Like everyone breathes.
Everyone has to breathe.
But that, although kind of that's a slightly kind of depressing fact that it affects so many people, and it affects you from your first breath to your last breath through your life. What it also means is that a small reduction has a huge impact.
Yeah.
Even if we bring it down a couple of micrograms, it could be
the lives of millions of people.
Yeah.
So I gave you my journey to work, and we're going to have a look at the different ways that I get there and see which one is actually probably the best for my health. So I've chosen So I go from Brixton to South Kensington, and I work at Imperial. And so I've got a cycle where I cycle from Brixton to Imperial, and I go over Chelsea Road Bridge, or I get the tube from Brixton to Victoria to South Kensington, or I get the train from Brixton to Victoria, and then walk from Victoria to South Kensington. So how is my exposure different on those different journeys, and what's better for me?
So out of those three, well, it's an interesting thing because there's a balance between doing physical exercise and being exposed to pollution. Right. So out of those three, probably your lowest exposure is your overground train and then walk.
Okay.
That's probably your lowest kind of pollution exposure.
Okay.
And the cycling's probably in the middle, and then the tube is without doubt the highest.
Yeah.
But you have to balance that against the benefit of physical exercise. So when you're sitting on the train, you're not exercising.
Yeah.
Well, you are when you're walking. When you're cycling, you're exercising a lot. But your exposure is probably increased a bit because you're breathing more and you're cycling through traffic. So out of those three, I would say that cycling was probably the best. There's been a few studies that have looked at this kind of trade-off between the extra benefit of physical activity of cycling versus this like disbenefit of extra exposure to pollution. And this was done in Barcelona and Boston as well. In European cities, and this goes for London as well, you're always better. So, like, the benefit of cycling always outweighs the slight disbenefit of extra exposure.
Right, okay. So I'm always best to actually do that cycle ride.
Oh, yeah.
And you're saying that the tube was the worst. Is the pollution on the tube particularly bad?
It's a really tricky one. There's quite a lot of unknowns about the tube at the moment. So if we just look at kind of particle number the concentration of particulates on the tube, it's really high, really, really high.
Right.
But it's different. So overground, when you're walking through the streets, like through here in Soho, you're next to traffic, you're next to combustion, you're next to diesel exhaust and petrol exhaust, and you're getting those particulates and that nitrogen dioxide that we were talking about earlier. And the World Health Organization has classified diesel exhaust as a carcinogen. So
right.
We know that that's bad. On the underground, obviously, there's no combustion. There isn't diesel or petrol on the underground. What is in the underground is the brake wear from the tubes breaking into the enclosed space of the,
right,
of the underground. And so it builds up over
time.
So
it's particulate, but it's maybe not.
It's mainly iron oxide.
As bad. Okay.
Iron oxide and some copper and some barium as well. And so there's still a question mark at the moment as to how toxic that is for human health or not. And actually, the mayor in July announced a new program of cleaning up the tube because it's not just kind of metal particulates. There's also kind of loads of old skin cells and bacteria and
all that kind of grimy stuff. So most of what you're doing actually is analysing the air quality all across London, and particularly you're interested in monitoring it. So how do you go about monitoring these things? Do you walk around with a little device that tells you what they are? How does it go about?
Most people think that I walk around all day with something in my hand.
Like a specialised backpack or something. It looks like kind of Ghostbusters. That's how I imagine.
Well, in fact, we do. I haven't, but we do have some students walking around with backpacks on.
Okay. You give that to the grad students.
Yeah.
Okay.
Occasionally. But mostly it's done kind of autonomously, silently. There are little kind of grey boxes at the side of the street that you walk past that you would never notice.
Yeah.
That have analyzers inside them, drawing in the air 24/7 and monitoring for these different pollutants. So inside these monitoring stations, there is an analyzer which will be monitoring the PM10 particulates we were talking about, one for PM2.5. One for nitrogen dioxide, one for ozone, one for sulfur dioxide, etc. So we have like different analyzers that measure the air all the time and produce a reading every hour. So what we do is we download the data from all of these monitoring stations. There's about 100 across London, and there's about just over 100 across the rest of the UK as well,
right,
in the national network. There's loads more that councils do, because it's mainly councils that do the monitoring, because they have kind of a legal duty to monitor the air in their area.
To make sure it's at a safe level for everyone.
Yeah, exactly. But there's a huge advantage to kind of pooling all that data into one database, because it provides an enormous kind of research resource for people to then to do quite sophisticated analysis on it, trends over time, how changes in traffic are affecting what we're seeing. So it's the monitoring is done for compliance to make sure that we're meeting kind of the levels that we should be. But on top of that, because we have this database of almost a billion records going back into the mid-90s, there's loads of researchers are able to do.
So this is now like a big pool of data that you can draw on to draw different conclusions.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, so we're going to have your third song. And you've chosen Tomorrow by Jono McCleary.
Oh, yeah.
And this is particularly close to you. Why?
Yeah, Jono is someone else that I came across in the London music scene in the mid-2000s, which doesn't seem that long ago, but I guess it's quite a while ago now.
Yeah, it is.
He's such a lovely guy. I love his music, and his voice is the type of voice where he could sing anything and I would listen to it.
Tomorrow at the same time, the same feeling will arise, and you will know by then to go down the straight and narrow. So move on to
just 5 days into 2007, the annual air pollution limits in London were breached.
So this is a fact that I've actually heard before. And you were saying that there are different limits. It depends which one we're actually talking about, whether it gets breached or not. Mm. Do you know what this is referring to? Or?
Yeah. Yeah, there's at the start of every new year, there's always a race to see which monitoring station is going to kind of breach its limits for the year first. And it's usually within the first week. So the pollutant we're talking about is nitrogen dioxide. And nitrogen dioxide is really the one that London has most of its trouble with. There's two measures for nitrogen dioxide. There's an annual limit, which is 40 micrograms of NO2 per meter cubed of air.
Right.
As an annual mean. Mm-hmm. And then there's another one, which is a monitoring station shouldn't read more than 200 micrograms as a one-hour mean more than 18 times in a year.
So this is like a peak. It shouldn't peak more than this for a short amount of time.
Exactly. And we have several roads in London which are regularly above 200 micrograms. And so quite often, I mean, it's very dependent on the weather. Like if we have a wet and windy January, then it won't happen for a while. And if we have a very cold, still start to the year, then it can be, you know, within the first couple of days of the year that this is breached. But it's still an indicator of the size, the scale of problem that we have, particularly with nitrogen dioxide. That annual limit of 40 micrograms, there are roads in London which are two or three times that limit. So there's a long way. For nitrogen dioxide, there's a long way to go. If you look at particulates like PM10 and PM2.5, if you look at the UK limits for those, we're mostly in compliance with the PM10 and 2.5 limits. So for PM10, it's 40 again. For PM2.5, it's 25 as an annual mean. But the World Health Organization has lower limits for PM10 and 2.5. So for PM10 it's 20, and for PM10 for PM10 it's 20, and 2.5 it's 10. Last week, or maybe the week before, the mayor signed London up to a program called Breathe Life 2030, and the aim of that is to try to meet these lower World Health Organization limits by 2030, which is quite ambitious.
So a bit more stringent, and this all, you know that you were meeting these limits because you have all this massive data that we were talking about before. What do you then do with that data? What you were saying before that you do a kind of modeling. How does the data feed into that, and what do you get out of it?
Yeah, so we have a modeling department at King's as well, and you may have seen these kind of like yellow and red pollution maps of London, that kind of cover the whole of London.
Yeah, so you have a website that shows this.
Yeah.
And what is that?
Londonair.org.uk.
And you can go on there and see what the current pollution is like.
You can see what the current levels are like, and you can also see what pollution is like kind of through the year, like with their annual maps. So kind of what it's generally like through the year. And it's these annual maps that are colored those kind of yellow and red colors. And those maps are 20-meter resolution. So the monitoring stations, there's about 100 of them across London, and they'll give you like really detailed idea of what the pollution is like exactly at that point. Mm. But obviously, you want to know... Well, like, we can't monitor on every single street. Yeah. And you want to know what every street is like. So then... What the modelling department do is create a model on top of the monitoring data, essentially, to kind of model what it's like, interpolate between all of these monitoring stations. And then once you have that model, and it's quite sophisticated, there's loads of kind of traffic data goes into it. It's constantly updated to make sure it's kind of reflective of what's currently happening. Once you've got a model, then you can do quite sophisticated kind of forecasting. So you can say, what would happen if all of the taxis were electric, or what would happen if we introduced the low emission zone, for example.
Right, so you can actually see how these different things affect the level of pollution on the model, and maybe help to choose between different things.
Exactly, yeah. But of course, for low emission zones, the modelling is the model of forecasting that you do is based on the expected emissions from the new vehicles that are coming onto the road. So new Euro class vehicles, you know, Euro 5, Euro 6 that we're getting up to now.
And these are emission standards for the vehicles.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
Which are, and the idea is that every new Euro standard comes out, the emissions that are allowable from those new standards get continually lower.
Right.
So the idea is, as old vehicles fall out the bottom of the fleet and people buy new vehicles, really over time, pollution should just keep getting better and better.
Because they're now subject to more to tighter regulations. Yeah. They can't emit as much pollution. And hopefully we should tend to less and less pollution.
Yes. But that's,
ideally.
But that's not what's been happening. If you go back to the early 2000s and look at kind of the model projections of where we should be now, we're nowhere near that now. And what we saw from the monitoring stations was that pollution was just essentially flat.
Right.
So why was there this difference between what should have been happening and what was actually happening was that diesels were emitting far more on the road in the real world than they were in the tests, in the lab tests.
Yeah, okay.
And of course, we found out that Volkswagen was deliberately cheating those tests. But so far, I think it's still Volkswagen that has only been found to be deliberately cheating. But it's still the case that lots of diesel cars emit far more on the road in real life than they do under these test conditions. And so that's one of the big reasons why we haven't improved as much as we should have.
Oh, wow. So it was these models weren't quite right. And so we thought we were doing better than we actually were. That's a real shame. So we're going to move on to your next song. And you've chosen Land of Talk, Summer Lakes. Why did you choose Summer Lakes?
I really like... Well, there's loads of Canadian bands I really like. And I could have... You know, we were talking earlier, there was one of several Canadian bands that I could have picked. But I really like Elizabeth's voice. And I like songs that are quite kind of hypnotic, like you feel like they could go on, and this is one of those. Started out a summer way, a sentence and a name, only for a moment's sake, called it and it came, held it down with loving heat, longer than a line, held it down. Softer than the tide. We sing high
By particulate matter, PM10 and PM2.5 Zabel, Iran is the most polluted city in the world.
Science News!
Quantum dots used to defeat superbugs.
Pollution from ships creates lightning.
Can being born by C-section make you fatter?
So, I mean, we're going to start off with those. We've got a couple more, but we're going to run through those later. Let's start with C-section. Can C-section make you fatter? What?
Well, apparently. So scientists in NYU have been doing some experiments on mice where they're comparing mice been born with C-section against mice born by normal delivery. And it seems that when you're born by C-section, it changes the microbiome in your gut. So then later in life, these mice have been more susceptible to obesity.
All right. So wait. Yeah. So this is because is there something that happens when you're born that?
I think as you go through your mother's
birth canal.
Good save. she seems to pass some of her microbiota to you.
Okay.
So then, if you're born by C-section, you don't have that microbiota, and apparently, in later life, you
need it.
Yeah.
Oh wow. So I know that there's some particularly I'm not going to say disgusting, but it's you know, you can have a transplant of these sort of biota, where you take the fecal matter from one person and inject it into another.
Really?
And that actually can change this microbiome in your gut, and it's been helpful for lots of things,
okay.
Like you know, different diseases and stuff. So maybe,
so
even if you're born by
then.
C-section, you can just get a poo transplant.
Sure.
And you'll be fine.
Lovely.
So I found this stuff on quantum dots used to defeat superbugs. So this is something that actually I'm quite interested in, because these quantum dots are something that I work relatively closely with. And so the basis of this is that there's this rise of these drug resistant bacteria, and because people are using a lot of antibiotics, that they are actually the diseases and are starting to develop resistance to them. And so these pathogens are resistant and can be quite difficult to fend off. And so this is a new approach that uses a quantum dot to bind to the antibiotic. And a quantum dot is a very small piece of semiconductor. And in this case, they use a material called cadmium telluride. And it's only a few nanometers across. And the blobs are so small that it actually changes the way that the semiconductor absorbs and emits light. And it means that you can shine a very narrow band of light on it, and that ejects electrons. And those electrons make ionized oxygen. And that oxygen then interferes with the bacterial function and improves the function of the antibiotics. There's a bit of a problem with this at the moment, that you need to shine green light on it, and your skin absorbs green light. So it can only be done in very narrow or very, very close to the skin. But they're working on using different quantum dots that absorb light of different frequencies. So maybe you could actually go in and get light shone into you, and it makes the antibiotics far more effective. And this is a way of defeating these superbugs, because there's been a lot of stuff in the news recently about the people developing resistances, and it's causing problems that now we're developing these bugs that can't be defeated by the antibiotics that we currently have, which is quite dangerous. So, Andrew, what did you notice in the news this week?
Well, perhaps unsurprisingly, it's a pollution-related one. It's some research out of University of Washington, where they looked at the prevalence of lightning strikes around the world. I find this extraordinary, but they analysed 1.5 billion lightning strikes,
wow.
Which is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, it's something like every 40 seconds or something, there's a lightning strike
around
the world.
Yeah. And what they found was that lightning strikes were twice as likely to happen in shipping lanes than elsewhere. And so they kind of tracked it down to the fact that ships use a lower grade of fuel than we put into our cars, and it has more sulfur in it. We were talking about sulfur dioxide earlier. So these kind of sulfur dioxide and sulfur particles are released into the air above the ships as little kind of particles, and then moisture from the atmosphere kind of forms around the particles to form a moisture, a blob of moisture, which then
like
kind
a
of
raindrop, sort of,
yeah, rain,
but small.
Yeah, that all then joins together to form clouds. So there's more clouds forming above the shipping lanes, and those extra clouds then eventually lead to more lightning strikes, which is
wow.
Yeah, pretty good.
So I also saw this week that they've launched a new satellite to monitor pollution.
Yeah.
It's called the Sentinel 5P,
yeah.
And it's to monitor pollution, but globally. Mm. And this is going to help with your research as well, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, one of the important things about pollution, it doesn't respect city boundaries or national boundaries. It moves between countries. It moves around the world. This is going to really help particularly with our forecasting. We do pollution forecasts every day that you can get on the London Air website. And particularly when we have high pressure systems and we have air coming from kind of Poland, Germany, the Netherlands across to us, this is really going to help us see how much pollution there is and how much we can expect on those kind of import days.
So it's going to make a big difference. Oh, well, we're running out of time, unfortunately. So we're going to have to move on to your next song, which was Weird by Reef. Why did you choose Weird?
Reef, I think, are my favourite band of all time.
Okay. I mean, that's a good enough reason. Let's have a listen.
One of the earliest controls for air pollution was a proclamation from 1272 by King Edward I banning the burning of sea coal.
So it's been around for a while, this legislation.
Mm.
How does the work you do actually feed into legislation, into making laws?
My boss, Dr. Gary Fuller, who is amazing.
Yeah, well done. That promotion's coming up. Yeah.
He did a I mean, we do lots of kind of reports like this a lot, but he did a really interesting study recently where we looked at kind of the monitoring stations that we have as a family, and kind of looked at how they had changed over time. And what we found was that there were monitoring stations which had improved by a reasonable amount on some roads and were getting worse on other roads. And that kind of points towards where you should do your investigations. Like what has changed with the traffic on the roads that have improved?
Right.
Figure out what you've done there and then see if you can apply that across the rest of the city. So I think... The monitoring data, aside from just telling you whether you're above or below the limit, it can point in the direction of where you should target your policies. And the same is true of diesel as well. It was a chap called Dr. David Carslaw who first kind of noticed this. What he called direct NO2, where we were seeing more nitrogen dioxide emitted directly from vehicles, particularly from diesels, kind of in the early 2000s, and that really kind of was an alarm bell for this increase in dieselization that we were seeing in the UK. In the UK, if you look at graphs of diesel sales in the UK, we go from about 10% of the fleet in the early 2000s to now 50% of the fleet, and that's because diesel was incentivized,
yeah,
because it was lower CO2 emissions than petrol, but now we see it has
problems all of its own. And,
yeah.
And do you think that drive to reducing the diesel, you know, fumes, that's the direction that we're going on at the moment? That's going to be that's going to have the biggest effect on the air pollution that we see at the moment. Is that
yeah.
true?
Yeah, and in fact, we're already seeing a drop in diesel sales. I think the SMMT last week or the week before recorded a 20% decrease in diesel sales year on year. I guess because people, well, one, the message is getting through that it's a polluting form of transport, but I think also people are worried about the potential for having to pay to get into cities. You know,
right.
Oxford is
now congestion charges.
Low emission zones, congestion charges. Oxford's talking about banning, cars completely from the city centres. So I think that's starting to feed through. And electric vehicle sales are up a little bit, a few percent. It's still quite a low percentage, but I think things are starting to move in the right direction.
So it's positive. We've got some change.
Yeah, I'm always hopeful.
That's good. As long as you're optimistic. Well, we're running out of time here on the show. I think we're going to have time to have a little check back at our quiz. So, Kira, do we have any guesses for that? What does everyone think in the studio? What do we think homoclophobia is a fear of? If you know the answer, that's fine, but no?
Fear of hermits.
Fear of hermits. Hermits? Do you want to have a guess? Homoclophobia? I'm thinking like chlorine, a fear of pools? I don't know.
Yeah, I've absolutely no idea at all. But there were some really good guesses from people listening today. But homoclophobia is actually a fear of fog.
Somewhat related to today's thing.
Yeah.
That horrible fog. Well, it only remains for us to thank our guest, Andrew Grieve. Thanks for joining us. Thank you to Louise and Kira. You've been listening to this edition of Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. If you enjoyed the show, let us know. We're on Twitter at Science Mixtape. And if you're listening to the podcast version, leave us a comment and rate the podcast on iTunes or any of the other podcasting app. It helps others find us. We're going to finish off with your last song, Andrew, which is Monsters, Something for Kate. Why did you choose this?
I spent a year in Australia after uni, as a lot of people do, in 2000-2001. And this came on the equivalent of MTV there, which is called Rage, at kind of at 1 a.m. or something when we'd come back from a night out. And I just thought it was really unusual and weird. And then I grew to like it. And I still really love it.
Brilliant. Well, thanks for joining us. And thank you. And goodbye.
I was hanging upside down from the overpass, waiting to discover something about the world. I couldn't get with the program and I couldn't listen to them. It was like trying.